In the process of telling the story of London, all 85 parts of the story so far, there have been things I've discovered I never expected I'd have to deal with along the way. I mean, for example, I did not think I'd end up spending so much time talking about wider geopolitical events, but found out quickly that sometimes this was inevitable due to, well, the nature of wider geopolitical events. And one of the things I kind of knew about, but really only appreciated while making this series, has been looking at London's peculiar right, as it was called in the charter of the commune of the city given to it back during the anarchy. What peculiar right? Well, the peculiar right of London to pick the kings of England. It's actually very easy to see how this tradition started. By standing alongside King Æthelred Unred, London had defied the rest of the country in insisting that their choice for king should be in charge. And after he passed on, London decided Edmund Ironside should be king, supporting him when all others refused. It was London who later chose King Harold I to be King of England. And after Harold II, Harold Godwinson, had fallen at the Battle of Hastings, it was the community of London who insisted Edgar Aetheling take the throne. And then, of course, London had chosen King Stephen, the grandson of the Conqueror, to become King of England, even defying the Empress Matilda to maintain their covenant with them. And now, in the story, in the year 1215, it was about to do that again. England, around London, was in a unique position. What appeared to be something truly new and radical was taking place. The king was subservient to a group of nobles. Not even the Witangamot of Saxon times had this much power. Something revolutionary was happening, and London was at the heart of it. But how long would this state of affairs last? Hi there, my name is Saul, and this is The Story of London, a podcast dedicated to telling the history of the city of London as it travels and meanders through time. We have reached the second part of the year 1215 and have come to the tale of the second part of that crazy year when London was to drive the nation into war. Welcome then to chapter 85 of The Story of London, The Commune of the Realm. In the latter part of the year 1215, a committee of 25 men, comprising of 24 barons supplemented by the Mayor of London, were in control over England. They had just forced the king to accept their rule, sitting in judgment over all the land. This committee was unlike anything people had ever seen before. They existed without oversight. Only the 25 could judge if the 25 were being too harsh or being unjust. Everyone had to swear to obey them, from the poorest to the king himself. If one of them was to be killed, they would automatically select a replacement. At a majority vote, the members could act on behalf of the whole committee. They could act upon any dissent and were bound together by an oath to aid each other come what may. In other words, this was a revolutionary tribunal. It sounds like I'm describing the Committee of Public Safety that was to be found in the later French Revolution. King John, stricken now with gout, aging, and not having fully recovered after his failure to reclaim his holdings in France, would have to be carried in a litter in order to answer their summons, forced to come to them and not the other way around. The world did appear turned upside down. Of course, to these men, any cruelty they were doing to John were merely what he had done to others. They were giving him a taste of his own medicine. And certainly, this seemed to incentivize the king to do whatever it is they wished. The 25 brought up many examples of the excesses of royal power that he had committed, and John settled 50 such cases after a meeting with the 25 in June 1215. Of course, it should come as no surprise then that the 25 did exceptionally well out of this arrangement, Richard de Clare was granted Buckingham, and Robert Fitzwalter was granted Hertford Castle. But the king quite literally had no power. A proof of this? Consider the example of the 23rd of June, 1215. Geoffrey FitzGeoffrey de Mandeville, the Earl of Essex, put in a claim, and King John responded by simply asking if some local sheriffs could investigate the validity of the claim. However, before the day was done, duly intimidated, King John withdrew that order and simply rubber-stamped de Mandeville's demand. London, in all of this, was maintaining its virtual independence from the crown. No previous commune of the city had ever granted them this much power. The city's legal status, via the Magna Carta and subsequent agreements made between the king and the 25, were unique, and the implications were astounding. In a nutshell, London was treated as private property, and the king was reduced from being the sovereign ruler of the land, appointed by the Lord himself, to being little more than a contractual equal of a supposedly equal representative group of his subjects. This kind of thing we would expect from the 19th century, not the 13th. But while King John really had no choice in capitulating to the demands of the 25, he wasn't done yet. John was a political creature, after all, and possessed a great cunning. He understood something the 25 were much slower in grasping. Yes, royalist support in England had been reduced to a rump of core loyalists, but the passionate advocates for the rule of the 25 were also a minority. The main body of the population of the land were going along with things, but they could be won back. In the 13th century, as it is in the 21st, public opinion and public perception was all that mattered. Hearts and minds could be won. This was still all about politics. And in this respect, King John was miles ahead of these barons. Because one thing should be clear, John was acting weaker than he was. He was playing the humbled king, acting like the contrite and weakened, frail old man. Oh yes, he was physically weaker than he'd been, but he was playing a long game. He wanted public opinion to come over to him, and in this, his political act was simple. The more humbled and contrite John behaved, or was seen to behave, the more chance he had of winning people over later down the road. What's more, it seemed to begin to work quite quickly. Within just a few weeks, the 25, who had started being so incredibly confident, had seemed to start looking over their shoulder and getting nervous. By July 1215, we can see how bad it's getting. Robert Fitzwalter, the Marshal of the Army of God, wrote a letter to his fellow committee member, William de Aubigny of Belvoir. In this letter, he explained the basic problem the 25 had. They were soldiers first and politicians second. And since they were all sat in London, their men, who were soldiers first and soldiers second, were feeling cooped up, restless. You can imagine the situation for the Londoners, a large body of heavily armed knights stuck in urban garrison duty for weeks, now months. Not good. To help relieve any tensions within the city, the leaders of the Army of God had decided to arrange for a tournament to take place up in Stamford on the 6th of July, allowing the knights and soldiers to let off some steam with some mock violence. The problem was, Stamford was over 100 miles from the city of London. And here in this letter, only 3 weeks after their victory at Runnymede, we see Fitzwalter reveal how dangerous the situation had become. Quote, "Be it known to you as a fact that we have been forewarned that there are some who are only waiting for our departure from the city to take possession of it on a sudden," unquote. To prevent this from happening, Fitzwalter made an executive decision and decided to move the tournament to a heath located between Staines and Hounslow. A local noble lady offered an actual bear to be given to the victor of the competition. and it took place, no doubt, to the great delight of the man-tanks in armour, if not so much for the poor bear being offered as a prize. But John's games of politics continued, and by July 16th, he gained his first political victory. At ongoing meetings where the king was being asked to fulfil his obligations to the Magna Carta, the 25 had also promised to fulfil oaths to that Magna Carta agreement, including swearing to be loyal subjects of the king. But at a meeting in Oxford, the barons refused to take the oath. This was done in front of the bishops and Archbishop of Canterbury, and they immediately said the 25 have broken their word publicly. The meeting at Oxford was a PR victory for King John, a big one, and like some politician today seeing a news headline to give them a story to harp on about, John picked up on the arrogance of the Committee of the 25 and drummed it home. He was doing well. And then he unleashed his trump card. You see, John had been lying this whole time. Those claims by the more radical elements of the 25 and their supporters that King John could not and should not be believed or trusted at any point were, strictly speaking, completely true. John had written to his new best friend in Rome, the reconciled with him Pope Innocent III, and in his letter he explained everything. And the Pope, who had last written to England demanding the barons drop this whole thing and had been ignored, he hit the bloody roof. And his intervention was savage. The document he sent is known by its first line, badly pronounced in Latin as Miragi cogimur et moveri, or as we say in English, we are compelled to wonder and be moved. And in this document he said that the barons involved in the Committee of the 25 were, quote, undoubtedly worse than Saracens, since they endeavoured to expel from his kingdom him who it was rather hoped would offer assistance to the Holy Land, unquote. Yeah, that little gesture King John had made to take the cross, to say he was gonna go on crusade, yeah. That worked. That compounded the sins of the 25. This papal bull then thundered that the Pope, quote, on behalf of the omnipotent God the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Ghost, and by the authority of the apostles Peter and Paul, and by our own authority, lay the fetters of excommunication on all these disturbers of the King and Kingdom of England, as well as on all their accomplices and abettors, and place their possessions under ecclesiastical interdict, unquote. The Pope ordered the Archbishop of Canterbury and all of England's bishops to proclaim this excommunication, quote, solemnly, throughout all England on every Sunday and feast day amidst the ringing of bell and with burning of candles, unquote. And he added that if any bishop balked at this or even hesitated about doing it, they were to be suspended from their position immediately. There was to be no appeal. The Pope had spoken. Deal with it. One can almost hear the sound of a 13th century microphone being dropped. The Pope also bypassed what he felt was politically compromised Archbishop of Canterbury, and had chosen a papal legate, the Bishop of Winchester, and the Abbot of Reading to enforce his edicts. And by the 5th of September, these three had added additional meat to the Pope's bare-bone argument. They published a letter which excommunicated the baron leaders by name and specified their offences, and it went further. It placed the City of London specifically under interdict as being complicit in the barons' disobedience. And then it also extended the sentence of excommunication to the barons' clerical associates. These are men called Giles, the Bishop of Hereford, William, chaplain of Robert Fitzwalter, and somebody we've never met before called Alexander the Clerk. Who were these men? It is felt by some that these were the ones who had supplied the intellectual underpinning for the baron's case and the Magna Carta. They were the secretariat, translating the demands of their lords into Latin and putting them into proper form. They wrote their letters. They wrote their propaganda. They preached sermons on behalf of the 25. And they were the ones who were maintaining religious services in London's churches in defiance of the papal interdict. And then the Pope came down on the Magna Carta itself. Pope Innocent III denounced this charter as shameful to the English nation and seriously damaging to the projected crusade John was never going to march on, but Innocent was all up trying to organise. The Pope actually forbade King John from keeping his oath to observe the Magna Carta, and then banned the barons from any attempt to hold the king to his word to enforce it. And he condemned the Magna Carta itself, finally and utterly, as, quote, null and void of all validity forever, unquote. The Magna Carta was dead, at least according to the Pope. And for the Committee of the 25, they discovered that John had been seeking papal condemnation since the end of June. To them, these edicts were just proof he'd been lying the whole time, that they were dealing with a perfidious character. They were too far gone now to back down. And that was it. It was war. The first battlefield happened to be right on London's doorstep. John needed mercenaries to come fight for him. He needed to land them at somewhere like Dover, where they could march up and reinforce him. As such, he relocated to the Kent coast in September to meet them as ships were coming. There were delays, however, due to terrible autumn gales. An experienced organiser of his mercenary forces, a man called Hugh de Beauvais, was drowned when his transports, which were bearing an army of Flemish mercenaries, were overwhelmed by heavy seas. Apparently that September, a multitude of corpses of Flemish mercenaries were washed up on the coast of Suffolk. The rebels decided to take advantage of this slight delay by making a bold march on Rochester to bar the king ever advancing on London. Rochester became the key location, as it had during the rebellion against King William II. William de Aubigné seized it first, and John quickly placed it under siege, one of the most brutal sieges in English history. William Fitzwalter and the Army of God led a force of about 700 knights out from London on the 26th of October to relieve Rochester. But they only got as far as Dartford. Then they heard a rumour that John's forces were now marching against London, so they turned around and returned back to hold the capital. The rebels had already opened negotiations at the French court for sending troops to aid them, and it's probable they expected Rochester to hold out until this relief force arrived. Certainly, after that failed attempt, they made no other serious effort to relieve the castle. They had reckoned, however, without French caution and without John's determination. De Aubigné held out for another 5 weeks or so, but on the 30th of November, that exhausted of supplies and facing the threat of starvation, the rebel garrison was forced to surrender. Ignoring this setback, the Committee of Barons in London now effectively said that John had deposed himself as king and summoned the nobles of England to attend to pick a new one. The royalist nobles, and indeed most of the nobles, refused to attend, but the committee carried on anyway. They were going to pick a king, but the war was going against them. Roger of Wendover blamed the failures of the 25 on their indolence while they were based in London. He described them, quote, playing a damnable dice, selecting for themselves the best wine for drinking and practising who knows what else beside, unquote. But the truth was the 25 were actually in a desperate situation. They controlled the eastern part of England and the north, but that was it. And they were handicapped by a lack of an effective army. There was something like 150 castles held against them, and they still had, it seemed, no siege engines. They'd missed the opportunity of attacking the king when he'd come up to Rochester, and since then, he'd been steadily reinforced by new swarms of mercenaries coming from the continent. They badly lacked a properly equipped field army, and they realised the only way they could get any advantage was to seek out external allies. Now, the Welsh were on their side, or some of the Welsh were on their side, but they wouldn't stray from their hills. And the Scots were offering support, but they could hardly field an army, and it didn't stray too far south. For the forces in London, including Mayor Hardell, there was only one foreign viable option to turn to. While John was preoccupied with the siege of Rochester, the rebels sent off a delegation to the French court begging for help and offering the crown to King Philip Augustus's son, Louis. Remember, it had only been a couple of years since it looked like the French were going to invade to put Louis on the throne anyway. Louis was quite eager, but his father at first appeared lukewarm. He wished to know if the rebels were determined or merely desperate, and he demanded some security for his son. Louis, however, promised to send over what help he could in a private capacity. He deferred coming over himself, but sent a contingent of knights at the end of November. They landed in the Orwell estuary and made their way to the rebel headquarters in London, but were not much help to the cause, and they ended up remaining there all winter. And apparently one of King John's Flemish mercenary commanders scornfully commented that now they were having to make do with unaccustomed beer because all the wine in the city had run out. John did not treat their arrival very seriously. On the 20th of December, he held a council in St. Albans, and he decided to divide his forces. A detachment under the Earl of Salisbury was left to keep the rebels pent up in London, while he set about recovering control of the rest of the country. Please note, King John was very wisely avoiding attacking London. John didn't have the partisans within the city ready to open the gates for him, and so a siege of London would have followed, and that would have been difficult and prolonged. But added to that, at this moment, he needed cash to pay for these mercenaries he had been bringing in. The machinery of the revenue-collecting system of the country had been utterly disrupted for months. Westminster had fallen from him when the rebels took London, and John was probably living largely on the remains of his stored wealth, of his castle treasuries. The best way to pay for his mercenaries, then, would be to allow them go on a rampage and pillage as they wish from the lands of the rebels. And this policy worked. Across England, John's drive into rebel territory brought him money, and the war seemed to swing violently in his favour. But in London, the regime of the Committee of the 25, which from a city's point of view was led by their mayor, held on. And they were now determined to offer the title of King of England to the heir after the French throne, Prince Louis. He himself had ferried more troops into London in January and February of 1216, and he was proposing to come over himself at Easter. The pros and cons of his intervention were discussed by the French barons in April 1216. The French king and his son by now had made up their minds to get involved, but it still remained for them to justify this expedition to the French barons. John was widely condemned in the French court for the murder of his nephew Arthur, and he now seemed rejected by his own barons. And Louis did have a claim to the throne through his wife, who was the granddaughter of Henry II. All Louis required was his father's blessing to lead the men of his own fiefs and whomever else want to follow him on a private enterprise. And he got it. For the first time since 1066, a formal invasion of England by a French army was to take place. King John spent the end of April and the beginning of May preparing to repel this invasion. The sheriffs of England were ordered to proclaim a general safe conduct and forgiveness for anyone who came to make his peace within a month of Easter. Anyone who failed to do so would be, according to the king, disinherited forever. John gathered his forces in Kent and went there himself to await developments. His prime reliance, however, was again upon his newly emerging navy. All ships were ordered to gather at the mouth of the Thames in preparation for an attack upon Louis's vessels, before they could put out from Calais. Remember, John had prevented the last proposed invasion of France by Prince Louis by destroying the French ships at port. So he ordered all his ships to be gathered at the mouth of the Thames or in Dover in preparation for an attack upon Louis' vessels before they could set sail from Calais. On the night of the 18th of May, however, a powerful gale howled through the channel, and in the morning his small fleet lay broken upon the shore or scattered at sea. There would be no relief. His plans were scuppered, and on the 21st of May, watchmen off the coast of the Isle of Thanet detected sail on the horizon. The next day, John himself watched as the hostile fleet passed safely across the mouth of Pegwell Bay. The French fleet of about 700 ships made their way up the River Medway and then the River Thames. Louis of France had invaded, and he sailed directly to London. Now, there were some changes that had taken place in the city when Louis arrived. You see, in the Easter of 1216, April the 10th that year, William Hardle had ended his term as the mayor of London. He had suffered excommunication over the task, and someone called John Alderman was made the new mayor of the city. John Alderman, however, was not to hold the position for long. He was out of office by May 30th, 1216. Why? Now, I've read two accounts of why this mayor of London served for such a short time. The first was that he died in office and a replacement needed to be found. But the other one is way more interesting. The Liber de Anticus says clearly that the reason he lasted only 50 days was, quote, being then condemned to lose the mayoralty, unquote. He was simply deposed from power. Why? What could he be doing that means he gets fired within 50 days? We do not know. Honestly, we don't. But to me, it feels like perhaps there was some kind of political power play in London. And what could cause a political power play in London? Well, look at the circumstances going on around the city. John Alderman took power just as the war was turning against the barons. London is under interdict and condemned. The previous Mayor Hardle had been excommunicated. Could it have been that John Alderman was opposed to the Committee of the 25? Maybe. But I don't think he would have been chosen to be mayor given the Mercer faction's control over the city during this period. It could be, and for me it feels, that maybe John Alderman was just not as militant as the other mayoral leaders of this rebellion. And if anybody's had any dealings with radical politics, you will know that the dynamics of such groups is, well, not being a militant is often seen as being a traitor. It's interesting to note who followed John Alderman as mayor. When he lost office in May 30th, quote, on the same day, Solomon de Basings was made mayor, unquote. Now, Solomon de Basings had been one of the two sheriffs of London, alongside his brother, who had become sheriff of London when Ceriola Mercer, the original London leader of this rebellion, had been made mayor. And it should be noted, he only held power till the next year when Ceriola Mercer was made mayor again. In other words, it does look like the faction that is the Mercers stayed in control during this period. For me, Solomon de Basings was part of the Mercer faction, the radical faction. And John Alderman, I can't help but feel, represented a moderate element within the London political scene. When he was elevated to power, the rebel forces were on the retreat. Maybe he was advocating a less militant approach to the war with King John, who was clearly on the front foot. But by the middle of May, Prince Louis was in town, and such a position would have no longer been in keeping with a more triumphant and empowered city. And as such, while I have no evidence to support this, for me, John Alderman was deposed by the militants in a political coup d'etat because they wished a more supportive militant candidate hold the position of mayor. Regardless of this, Prince Louis triumphantly made his way to London with an opulent procession to St. Paul's Cathedral. And there he was announced King of England. The city became the headquarters for Prince Louis, and sermons were given urging the residents to throw their support behind their French prince. But while London was now flushed and resolute, the rest of England was thrown into utter chaos. Louis went on the attack, and the rebels, who had recently made their peace with King John when he was on the front foot, now even quicker went to join Louis' camp. Men who had hesitated to break with the king for fear of the consequences now plucked up courage. Alexander of Scotland led his army across the border again. During this initial period, Prince Louis had his chancellor, who had come with him from Paris, who was the English-born brother of the current Archbishop of Canterbury, compose a written document giving his reasons to claim the throne and why John should not be king. And he said at the end, quote, "With the advice and approval of the commune of the realm, and judging him unworthy of the realm, elected us as king and lord," unquote. Prince Louis had the backing of the nation's commune, the Committee of the 25, the Hustings Court of the Magna Carta. That was enough for him. Quickly, Prince Louis began a rapid conquest of the southern counties, which in turn led to increased defections away from John. Several of them were surprising: the Earl of Arundel, the Earl of Surrey, and most shattering of all, the king's half-brother, William of Salisbury, all swapped sides. Loyalists who had stood by the king now saw his cause as hopeless. John was seemingly done for. Prince Louis, who was proclaimed king, even if he'd not been crowned yet, was clearly winning. But John was not beaten yet. By the end of that mad summer of 1216, the confused situation started to clarify itself. Two-thirds of the barons had gone over to Prince Louis, but there it stopped. Louis could not take Dover, though he personally directed operations against it. Meanwhile, relations were becoming strained between the rebels and the French barons who had come over, not as allies, but more in the hope of gaining some rich fiefdoms for joining in. The more English barons who went over to the prince's side, you see, the less the French nobles could gain from this situation. And then you add to this, Prince Louis had come to fight King John for the throne, but he had very clearly not said a damn thing about supporting the Magna Carta. Oh, he was glad to be chosen by the body of men empowered by the Magna Carta, but from himself, it never came up once. Louis was here to put Louis on the throne, and this made a difference. Added to this, well, the rebels had begun to lose some of their more firebrand and charismatic leaders. Eustace de Vesey was killed helping the King of Scots in a rather pointless siege. Geoffrey de Mandeville had been accidentally killed in a joust with a Frenchman. The Earl of Salisbury returned his allegiance to King John. One analyst said at the time, quote, "Day by day, the adherence of the Frenchman dwindled," unquote. The whole situation was a confusing and chaotic mess. Not since the anarchy had England been in such a state. And like the anarchy, London, actually, was fine. It had its King Louis of France, soon to be King Louis I of England. And while the situation was bad, it would only be a matter of time before their side won. And then King John pulled the most surprising and powerful political move he could pull. He died in the early hours of the 18th of October, 1216. A furious gale howled around the rooftops of the towns of Newark. Inside one of those buildings, King John of England, the last son of the great Angevin Henry II, died of dysentery. And like that, once again, the political situation changed. When the news of the king's death reached the royalists in the West Country, his eldest son, Henry, 9 years old, was quickly knighted, making, quote, a pretty little knight, unquote, and then was brought up to Gloucester, and there in the Abbey Church on the 28th of October, under the directions of a passing papal legate, he was crowned by the Bishop of Winchester, Henry, third of his name, King of England, with a circlet provided by his mother. The royalist barons, by all accounts, seemed deeply moved by this ceremony. And meeting the next day in the great hall of a nearby castle, they decided how to protect the interests of their new young king. And they prevailed upon William Marshall, who was now in his 70s, to act as regent. The situation was precarious. But as serious as the situation was for the loyalist forces of the boy king, it was not quite so grim as Marshall imagined it. John's death itself had helped the cause of his house, for many who had supported Louis had done so because, you know, John was a lying, covetous git. But John was gone. They didn't have a fight with a 9-year-old boy. And then William Marshall pulled a political masterstroke. At a solemn meeting of the Royalist magnates at Bristol, the Charter of Liberties was reissued in the young king's name. It wasn't the full charter that had come out a year before. Some of the more disturbing and hampering of the clauses of the Charter of 1215 were omitted or modified or held over for future debate. But its essential spirit was preserved. It is the supreme irony of the Magna Carta that after being demanded and won by rebels and then put to death by the Pope, it was now brought back as a royalist manifesto. As the winter of 1216 settled upon London, the entire situation around the city was in flux. In the city, support still held firmly behind their French king, and his battle cry, Mountjoy, would resound still. And it was kept alive in passionate sermons at St. Paul's Cathedral by a group of able clerics, including the Chancellor and Acting Dean of the Cathedral, Gervase Hobergen, and Simon Langton, the Archbishop of Canterbury's brother, and Elias of Durham, who had served two Archbishops of Canterbury. But the eloquence of these sincere and scholarly persons was in direct contrast with events elsewhere. Nothing this alliance could do seemingly prevented a gradual and growing attrition of forces, the threat of excommunication by the church, the repudiation of Louis's father, King Philip Augustus, of this whole enterprise. In fact, the whole enterprise was seemingly becoming an adventure, kept alive by the reckless gallantry of the French friends of Prince Louis and his own wife, Blanche of Castilia, whose descent from Henry II gave him his chief claim to the throne. The tide seemed to be turning against the London radicals. But even now, however, they had no cause for immediate alarm. Louis held the city, and because of that and his fleet, he controlled access to the Channel. He could strike where he pleased from interior lines. Like every war, like the anarchy had shown, this was really a matter of holding and capturing castles. This war was not yet lost. After all, they were fighting against a 9-year-old child. The commune of all the land, London's great power play, could still return to being on top. And if London had their way at this moment, then England would no longer be ruled by the Plantagenet dynasty. And I shall leave it there, and will return next episode for the conclusion of this war and the incredible solution inflicted upon the land. Thanks for listening. I really do hope you enjoyed it. I'll see you anon. Bye.